Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Hillary Clinton's brief press conference at the UN, where she answered questions about her use of email from a private server set up for her husband, former President Clinton, at their family home that is protected by the Secret Service. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Julia Unwin, author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance, joins us to discuss the double standard that high government officials want to protect their privacy while ordinary citizens have no privacy and are subject to both government and corporate surveillance, a subject that did not come up in today's press conference that was focused on the search for scandal that has long dogged the leading, if not the only, Democratic candidate for president in 2016. Then we'll look into the latest reorganization scheme at the CIA that is meant to make it more successful against threats in the digital age and better able to handle multiple crises. CIA veteran Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, joins us to discuss the Brennan Plan announced to CIA employees on Friday that relies on more fusion centers like the CTC, the Counterterrorism Center, that combines analysts with clandestine operatives and missed 9/11 was responsible for the intelligence failures to stop the Nigerian jockstrap jihadi, the suicide bomber who blew up the most sensitive CIA base in Afghanistan, and the recent failure to assess the burgeoning lethality of the so-called Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Then finally, we will speak with Gene Lyons, a nationally syndicated columnist with the Arkansas Times, to get a profile of the freshman Tea Party Republican Senator Tom Cotton, who drafted the open letter to the Iranian leadership signed by 46 other Republican senators, which is widely seen as a blatant attempt to sabotage President Obama's efforts to conclude a deal between the P5 plus one and Iran over its nuclear program. And joining us now is Julia Unwin, who is an award-winning investigative journalist at the independent news organization ProPublica. And in 2003, she was on the team of reporters at the Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. Her latest book is Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julia Unwin.
It's great to be here.
And Julia, the press conference of Hillary Clinton's was meant to try and put this story to rest. It's obviously become a sort of fevered story in terms of press coverage, not obviously because Hillary Clinton is likely to be running for president. And she has, I think, a fairly undisguised contempt for the press, which was evident in her body language. But at the end of the day, what do you think this scandal is, or this burgeoning or mini or manufactured scandal is about?
Well, I think the scandal is about a lot of things. One of them is a power struggle between the press and government, right? The press is supposed to be the watchdog for government, and freedom of open record laws are designed to give the press access to the workings of government. And she, it looks like, has tried to circumvent that process in some way. And so the press is outraged, and the press, as a member of the press, I say we are outraged on behalf of the public. we want to give the public the best idea of what's happening in government.
Well, her excuse essentially was that she thought that using one device would be simpler than having two devices, and that, I guess, is her best excuse. Now, what she didn't say, and which I think is relevant, is that she does use a BlackBerry, and BlackBerries aren't as easy as iPhones are in terms of, you know, you don't really need two devices with an iPhone, but its security is much less. So is that an argument she could have used?
I mean, she could have made an argument that the BlackBerry is a more secure device, but it is interesting to note that she didn't make that argument. and she talked about convenience. And I think the thing is, the advance that BlackBerry had in security, it was certainly true 10 years ago that BlackBerry had the most advanced security, but I think you could argue today that you could have equivalent security by having multiple devices. And also, the multiple device thing seems like a strange question, because let's say the BlackBerry is the most secure, then you just have an iPhone for your private information.
Well, what she did say, though, that one would have thought could have put some of this speculation to rest, but she certainly didn't emphasize it. And much is being made of the fact that she had a private server in a home in New York, upstate New York. But apparently that server was set up by the Secret Service for former President Bill Clinton, and she simply just joined in that server, or just she put her account with his, in effect. And she said, I think, in the press conference that, you know, that gives you more security and less likely to be hacked. What's your response to that?
Well, I looked carefully at what she said in the press conference, and she said that the server was on property protected by the Secret Service, and that's very different than actually the server being maintained and protected digitally by the Secret Service, because as most people have learned, hacks don't usually happen by somebody breaking into your house and getting to your actual computer. They happen remotely through some sort of attack over the internet. And so she basically described a situation where the Secret Service are protecting the perimeters of the home where the server is located. That has no bearing on whether the server itself was vulnerable to hacking. And in fact, she said there was no security breaches. But in fact, like, you have to prove that, because most companies don't know when they're hacked. And certainly I would imagine that Hillary Clinton is not necessarily an IT expert to know whether there's been a breach. Now, maybe she hired someone, but oftentimes intrusions are very hard to detect. That's why Google has teams all over the world of highly paid engineers to maintain the security of their servers. And so anyone running a secure server in their home should be concerned about hacking and probably should assume they're being hacked.
Well, there was a question about whether any classified information was involved in either the private emails or the government-related emails, and she made it clear that it wasn't. Now, I'm assuming that as Secretary of State and member of the National Security Council, she has a separate avenue of communication. Say, you know, remember she's the one who talked in the 2008 campaign about the 3 a.m. phone call? Well, you know, if the 3 a.m. phone call comes from the president, it presumably is a secure phone call.
Yeah, she may well have a secure channel for communications, but the problem is that we'll never know that as the public, because by not turning over the server and by she said she deleted the emails that she said were private, there's now no trail of what was or wasn't sent. I mean, she could have deleted some mistakenly classified material that was sent, and we would never know. So the problem of her owning the server and not turning it over for digital forensics means that the verifiability of that statement is in question.
And again, I'm speaking with Julia Angwin, who's an award-winning investigative journalist at the independent news organization ProPublica. In 2003, she was on a team of reporters at the Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Explanatory Reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. And her latest book is Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. So we don't really know about who scrubbed her private emails from the 55,000 printed pages in total that are government related. Presumably that's a big job. It took a while, didn't it? And it would have to had been Hillary Clinton making the final determination whether that's private or work related.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a job. I mean, the State Department has said it's going to take them months to scrub the emails that she did turn over. So you would have to imagine that it took some staff of hers months to get to the point where she could turn some over. The whole process has been so opaque that it's hard to know if that happened or not.
So what did you think of her explanation that she deleted stuff relating to her daughter's wedding and her mother's funeral, etc.? Do people normally delete that kind of personal stuff?
I mean, most people actually like to hang on to that kind of stuff. We live in an era where people are more likely to hoard their data than to delete it, and that's actually one of the problems we have is that, you know, I suspect that one issue with NSA, which we've seen, you know, they're collecting so much information, is that everybody sort of wants to have the most amount of data and doesn't want to let go of it because you never know when it's going to be useful. That said, you know, she may be one of those people who's willing to part with her past quickly. But I think that one of the ironies of this situation is that, you know, she's talking about how she wants privacy. And the truth is we're living in this world where all of us want that, right? But we're not being given it. The government is saying it has to be able to look through all of our data in order to find terrorists and find bad guys. And my question is, well, why do some people get it? Why does Hillary Clinton get to make this own judgment about what she gets to keep private, and the rest of us are an open book?
Well, it's no small irony that on this day that Hillary Clinton conducted this press conference, which was so highly anticipated, is the same day that Wikipedia and the Conservative Rutherford Institute, along with the ACLU, suing the NSA over spying, having access to private information.
Yeah, I mean, this is an ongoing public debate in which actually a lot of people are waiting for Hillary to weigh in on. Where does she stand on internet surveillance? Because when she was at the State Department, she was very outspoken about how the U.S. should lead the way in internet freedom, and she was talking about how repressive governments are censoring their citizens and we shouldn't allow that. And, you know, now we have a situation where she herself is taking some sort of privilege of a government officer to basically do her own self-censorship, right, to choose which emails to turn over. And, you know, hasn't addressed the issue of, like, why she gets to have privacy from the Open Records Act when the rest of us are supposed to be vulnerable to all sorts of government snooping. And so it would be nice to hear from Hillary where she stands on this, because she was on one side, and people are waiting to see where she stands on mass surveillance.
Well, clearly nobody asked that question. I mean, I guess...
As far as I can tell, it was a very short press conference.
It was, and a lot of the questions were quite repetitive. So I guess your hope then, Julia Unguin, is that at some point in the future, that very question is asked and answered.
I mean, luckily we have 2 years of presidential election ahead of us. Hopefully we'll get an answer on the question of our time, right, that Snowden raised for everyone, which is where do we stand on mass surveillance as a society?
And do you detect a double standard here, that a high-ranking government official wants privacy, but we in the public are not getting it because we don't know the extent to which the government is snooping on us?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strong double standard. You know, we see it in this example with Hillary Clinton, but it's not the only example. What we're seeing is that over and over again, the government claims the right of secrecy for itself, right? The amount of classified material has risen exponentially in recent years. The amount of denials of Freedom of Information Act requests has risen. And so we, the public, are being shut out more and more of government operations, while at the very same time, the government is demanding more and more information from us through its secret surveillance programs post 9/11, all in the under the rubric of protecting our safety. But in some ways, this is a struggle for power, right? This is the if they have the right to keep everything secret and we have to be an open book, we have less power as citizens.
So, in terms of the security that Hillary Clinton said that having this private service protected by the Secret Service, not necessarily monitored and set up by them, and she said that it was an insurance against hacking. Is there any insurance against hacking? I mean, all you hear every day in the news is how millions and billions of dollars are being ripped off people online. Even Apple Pay, which everybody thought was really secure, now the hackers have found a way to loot people's bank accounts via Apple Pay. So it just seems like in the world of cyberspace, and by the way, the CIA has just said that they're going to play catch-up and they need to have a whole cyber division. And, of course, you know, they're admitting they're behind not only their foes, but their friendly services have a greater ability to do surveillance. Like, for example, the Italians got all kinds of information on a bunch of CIA people who kidnapped a Muslim cleric from the streets of Rome. See, you've got John Brennan at the CIA saying, you know, we're behind in the digital age. But it seems to me that the criminals seem to be one step ahead of everybody, if you assume all hackers are criminals, which I suspect you can make that case.
Well, I mean, I think that you know, you only have to look at the intelligence community itself, right? The top people at the NSA and in the national security space say all the time, they say there are two kinds of companies in the United States. There are those who have been hacked, and there are those who have been hacked and don't know it, right? And so the fact is, you know, what we are hearing across the board is that hacking is the norm, that this decentralized system of communications called the internet that we know and love is extremely hard to defend because it's decentralized. And so for Hillary Clinton to say with calm assurance that she knows she hasn't been hacked, is very hard to square with the common understanding in the field that she professes to be an expert in national security, which is that everyone's being hacked all the time, and it's just a question of whether you know it or not.
Well, in her case, given that much of the hacking comes from China, you would think that she'd be a prime target, being a high-level government official and a member of the National Security Council.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that even her least sensitive emails aren't of great interest to a lot of foreign governments, and that they would go to great lengths to get them. And so I imagine she had a very strong set of adversaries trying to get into that home server. And unless it was protected by a team of, you know, the top DOD officials 24/7 monitoring every single incoming request, it's very likely that some intrusion might have gotten through.
So in a broad sense then, Julia Angwin, are we in this digital age just simply all vulnerable, and even a high-ranking government official like Hillary Clinton, she may have the illusion of security but doesn't really have it?
Sadly, I do think we are all vulnerable. I imagine maybe we'll get to a point where that's not true. But right now, I think the state of affairs is that everyone is vulnerable. There's no better example than Edward Snowden himself, who managed to walk out of the most secure, highly technically sophisticated agency with a huge amount of files, right? That in itself shows that even the most defended agencies with the most sophistication have difficult time protecting their data. And that's because we're living in a new world where data is flowing everywhere. It's very hard to keep track of it all, and it's very difficult to defend against all possible attacks because there are so many attacks out there.
But they're also happening in tandem, aren't they? The government is monitoring and surveilling us all. At the same time, the commercial entities are mining our data and monetizing it, and we get no value out of it.
That's right. And actually, the two are merging. You know, there's this new kind of threat that's been emerging where the ads that follow you around the internet, which are so creepy and based on data mining of your behavior, now sometimes they're being filled with malware that infects your machine for attackers. So soon you might see these two worlds merge into some one giant, machine that is very hard to get out of. Now, I hope that doesn't happen.
Well, but the conversation we are having is a conversation that Hillary Clinton should have had, right? I mean, I can't entirely blame her, because the press are on a hunt for this sort of scandal, and, you know, the Clintons have been a magnet for scandal, much of which has been manufactured, but certainly some of it that wasn't manufactured, that was handed to Clinton's opponents on a plate. So, you know, she did miss an opportunity. And whose fault is it? I mean, do you think the press is just really interested in this kind of scandal du jour? And it seems like a great opportunity for us all to have what Obama refers to as a teachable moment about internet privacy and security.
Yeah, I think it would have been great to have it as a teachable moment. And yes, that opportunity seems to have been missed, although I have a feeling that this isn't the last of this story, so we may have that moment later on. But in the end, I think that everyone is trying to grapple with this new world. You know, we're really new to this world of ubiquitous technology. It was only 10 years ago that we weren't really carrying around cell phones. And so it's still early days, and people are still trying to grapple with what does it all mean, and how vulnerable am I, and what are the risks? And we need to have a national conversation about it. I think it's just starting to happen. The Obama administration has proposed a privacy bill of rights, which actually both advocates of privacy and opponents dislike, so it's probably dead on arrival. But there is at least some movement about a conversation about, like, what can we do to better protect ourselves in this world?
So I guess just in closing then, Julia Angle, we can only hope that we know that the scandal's not going to go away. And just in closing, do you think that Hillary Clinton in any way closed the door on it in this rather brief and obviously uncomfortable press conference for her?
I definitely think the door is not closed. I mean, there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered about that server, what kind of security was being maintained on it, how she can assure us that there wasn't a hack, that it wasn't breached, that there wasn't classified material. And then I have to say there's just that very basic question, which is, like, what is it like for a world leader to get an email from the Secretary of State, not from the State Department's own domain, right? It does seem, if I dare say, a little amateur.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time, Julia.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Julia Angwin, who's an award-winning investigative journalist at the independent news organization ProPublica. In 2003, she was on a team of reporters at the Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Explanatory Reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. Her latest book is Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the latest reorganization scheme at the CIA. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. He is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And the head of the CIA, John Brennan, announced his new reorganization plan to CIA employees on Friday. What feedback are you hearing?
Well, I'm hearing a lot of feedback, and for the most part, it's negative. I think the people who understand what operations are about, which is policy, and the people who understand the importance of objectivity of intelligence analysis know that if you put the analyst in the same department with the operators, you are going to politicize the intelligence. And if you look at the classic cases of politicization over the last 20, 30 years, Iran-Contra, the intelligence for Iran-Contra to justify Iran-Contra was done in a center. And if you look at that national intelligence estimate that was done in October 2002, all of the false allegations that justified the invasion of Iraq, that was done in the Center for Counterintelligence. So it's a very dangerous step. It's a centralized step. It's a top-down step. It's another mark in the militarization of the CIA, which Bob Gates started in 91, 92, and Jim Woolsey continued in 93, 94. And now John Brennan, who came into the CIA as an analyst in the early 1980s, has really turned the place into a paramilitary organization.
Well, Brennan also comes out of the same the same experience that George Tenet had, which is more or less the CIA doesn't have a public relations division, but these guys are essentially PR men for the agency dealing directly with the executive branch.
Well, George Tenet at least had a notion, being a Hill staffer, that it was important to have a certain amount of public relations, and he opened up the agency in terms of media interviews and getting agency people out into the larger community. But under Brennan, the wagons are being drawn tighter and tighter. We're getting very little information out of the CIA. Brennan and President Obama have cooperated to finish off something that Leon Panetta started as CIA director, which was to kill the Office of the Inspector General, which was the major element and department for internal oversight of the CIA. So if you look at the congressional intelligence committees, particularly under the new Republican chairman, Richard Burr from North Carolina, he's an advocate for the CIA. He's not a watchdog. And that's not why the Senate Intelligence Committee was created. So, again, I see this as a real move towards centralization and top-down leadership, and that's the way Brennan operates. He doesn't delegate. He doesn't seem to trust the people around him. And he's going to take specialists and turn them into generalists. And when Henry Kissinger did that at the State Department in the early 1970s, this was the beginning of the decline of the State Department, where the kind of specialists you develop at State over the years, if you look at the Obama administration, they're not available to President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry. So this is a real dumbing down of the intelligence community and a serious dumbing down of the CIA.
And again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. And he's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. So this new reorganization plan that Brennan has come up with, which is to create more of these so-called fusion centers, like the CTC, the Counterterrorism Center, and the Counterintelligence Center. But the CTC, of course, missed 9/11, was responsible for the intelligence failures to stop the so-called Nigerian jockstrap jihadi, the suicide bomber who blew up the most sensitive CIA base in Afghanistan, and the recent failure to assess the burgeoning lethality of the so-called Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. You're saying that the very nature of these fusion centers are a recipe for disaster.
Well, what they do is they break down the bureaucratic wall that has always existed at the agency, going back to its creation in 1947, between the operational side, the clandestine side, which is part of the policy world, and the intelligence side, or the analytical side, which is a part of objective and balanced intelligence support for policymakers. And once you break down that wall, there's no limit to the kinds of politicization. And you mentioned failures. And the failures have continued right up to the present time. When you look at the failure, you mentioned the Islamic State. It was only a year ago that President Obama, because of bad intelligence, was referring to the Islamic State as Al-Qaeda's JV. And he made that remark that just because they put on Laker jerseys doesn't mean everybody is Kobe Bryant. Well, they totally underestimated. They were carrying numbers in terms of order of battle of 5,000 members of the Islamic State, and gradually they upped that to 30,000, and who knows what the actual number is. The failure with regard to Putin, the moves that were made in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, would just bring the intelligence failures right up to date, but it's the breaking of the bureaucratic wall. And then the paramilitary element, all of the things that Harry Truman warned about in a note that I got when I spoke at the Truman Library just this past summer. I got a note written in his own hand that he never intended the CIA to be a cloak and dagger outfit. It was intelligence collection and intelligence analysis, and he was appalled with what President Eisenhower and President Kennedy did with the CIA. When you think of the overthrow of the government in Iran in 1953, Guatemala in 1954, the Bay of Pigs in 1961. This is clearly not what President Kennedy had in mind. And, of course, when Senator Church came along in the 1970s and called the CIA a rogue elephant out of control, well, that was totally wrong. It's not a rogue elephant out of control. It's an elephant that's under the control of the President of the United States, whether he's a Democrat or a Republican.
Well, because Harry Truman said that
over the years.
I was going to say that Harry Truman also, when in 1947, he was reluctant about the creation of the CIA, and he said, "I don't want to create a damn American Gestapo."
Exactly, and only about a year or so before he died, he said that if I knew then what I know now about the CIA, I never would have created it in the first place. So if you look at the two intelligence agencies that were created under Truman, in the open, he created the CIA. But in secret, he created the National Security Agency, and look at the harm that's been done to civil liberties and privacy in this country by the National Security Agency. And now, as part of these reforms, Brennan has announced that he's creating a new directorate that's going to be responsible for integrating all digital and cyber capabilities. Well, when you look at NSA and its intrusion into our emails, into our phone communications, the monitoring of Wikipedia, the monitoring of Google, the monitoring of Facebook, all in violation of not only the NSA Charter but the Constitution, are we going to see similar violations by the CIA? Remember, It was John Brennan who lied to then-Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Dianne Feinstein, saying it would be beyond reason to think that we would break into the computers of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Well, they were not only breaking into the computers of the Senate system, they were breaking into the emails of Senate staffers. So it was hardly beyond reason. It's what they were doing, and they were doing it under the direction of Director John Brennan, who President Obama has called a patriot, some patriot.
Well, I was pretty astounded, Mel Goodman, when the announcement first came out of a press briefing that Brennan did last Wednesday about this starting this new cyber division and getting into the digital age. And he's admitting that the CIA is way behind the capabilities of not just the CIA's foes like China and Russia, but also friendly services are able to track suspects digitally, you know, with all the footprints from the various phones and faxes and emails and every electronic signal that you have today. I mean, we know that we are tracked by both the NSA and by commercial entities relentlessly. But the admission that we're behind, and of course, the first thing when you say you're behind, we have a cyber gap. We had a bomber gap, we had a missile gap, now we got a cyber gap, and guess what? We need more money. Well, in God's name, and what are they doing with all this money? I mean, they have more money than ever, don't they?
Well, the budget is way out of control. You know, once upon a time, you could really anticipate what the CIA budget was because you knew the intelligence budget was 10% of the defense budget and the CIA budget was 10% of the overall intelligence budget. But now CIA spending is really out of control as they've adopted this paramilitary role and particularly the drone program that Brennan said at his confirmation hearings that he was going to turn back to the Pentagon, that the CIA should get out of the drone business. Well, they're in the business bigger than ever and using it in more nations than ever before, including nations where we haven't even declared that we are at war. And frankly, I find it hard to believe that we're lagging in the digital area and the cyber area because I look at the Stuxnet virus that was introduced into the Iranian centrifuge system several years ago, where the CIA and the NSA cooperated with the Israeli Mossad intelligence agency to contaminate for a period of time the centrifuge production program in Iran. This was, to me, the most sophisticated use of cyber warfare that I have looked at over the last 5 years or so. But it's certainly going to be more widespread, and as you say, it's going to be the thin edge of a wedge to get more money out of the Congress because if they're trying to control defense spending, any controls on defense spending will also be replicated in the intelligence community. So it's like any agency, it's a bureaucratic imperative to find more ways to use more money and to justify more appropriations and more spending. And I think that's exactly what John Brennan is doing, just as General Michael Hayden did at the National Security Agency to go outside the NSA to develop a program to monitor all of our telephone calls, our emails, and all of our electronic communications, not only in foreign communities, but at home as well. So really, under the Obama administration, we've had greater investigations of leaks. We've had greater restrictions and limits on whistleblowers. We've had greater use of the intelligence community, both NSA and CIA, in violation of civil liberties, which is exactly what President Eisenhower warned about in the 1950s, that in any environment of permanent war, you're going to lose privacy and civil liberties. And that's exactly what's happened in this country over the 13, 14 years of the so-called global war on terror.
Well, Mel Goodman, when I was saying earlier about George Tenet being a kind of PR man, in the sense that he was a very political creature and became very popular at the White House and particularly during the first part of the war against Afghanistan, it apparently drove Cheney and Rumsfeld crazy that the CIA were running that war and that Brennan was Bush's new best friend, but in selling the war to Colin Powell, the Iraq war, he clearly was an agent of the White House, deliberately conning the Secretary of State, who The White House had designated to sell this war to the world via the United Nations Security Council because Powell had the most credibility. To me, that's one of the most cynical acts in government that I've ever witnessed.
Well, the cynicism was Secretary of State Colin Powell's. He was told by all of the major advisors around him, including the head of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, not to go out to the CIA to draft a speech to give to the UN, because the intelligence people at state knew that the estimate from October 2002 was totally phony, and they assumed that that estimate would become his speech in February of 2003. And that's exactly what happened. You know, if Powell were the courageous general and statesman that we think he is, he would have resigned from the Bush administration. He was opposed to the war. He tried to create speed bumps for the Bush administration, certainly into August and September of 2002. But once the estimate was written and it was clear that this administration, the Bush administration, was going to war, he either could have resigned or put on his three-piece suit and go to the UN, which Dick Cheney totally maneuvered and orchestrated, which to me showed the incredible weakness of Colin Powell. And to this very day, he remains angry because he knows he was lied to by the deputy director of CIA, John McLaughlin. Everyone knows that George Tenet made the remark about slam dunk, Mr. President, when he was asked to provide intelligence to take to the American people, that this would be no problem, Mr. President, this is a slam dunk. Well, the slam dunk briefing was given by his deputy, John McLaughlin, who George Tenet called the smartest person I've ever encountered in government. Well, John McLaughlin was also one of the most dishonest people in government, and that's what the slam dunk briefing was all about. It was about the same dishonesty that was introduced in the October 2002 estimate and the Paul Pillar white paper that was the unclassified paper, a violation of the CIA charter, by the way, because it was sent down to the Hill only 48 hours before the vote on the war. So there were outrageous things that were done, but under Brennan's reorganization, these things will be even easier in a centralized organization where you don't have competition between the analytic agencies, and now you have operators and analysts working under the same tenet. So this is a serious step backward, and it's a serious step away from what Harry Truman wanted when he created the CIA in the National Security Act of 1947.
So how much do you is the CIA, and given this politicization that you're talking about, and we've talked about some of the failures, and it's very hard to assess whatever the successes are. One of the things that I find extraordinary about U.S. foreign policy, particularly now with what's happening in Iraq, where the Iranians are basically taking the lead in this so-called battle against the so-called Islamic State, is that there is this, you know, refusal for anybody to look at the reality that, you know, the Islamic State this is not the Islamic State we're fighting. You can't, a few thousand of these Mad Max guys aren't holding all of Mosul and the rest of that territory. This is clearly, the Sunnis that we're talking about. The Iraqi Sunnis who have been cast into the wind. And there's this tendency on everybody's part to keep wanting to believe the fiction that there's still a country there, in the same way that we have this fiction that for the longest time that Pakistan's the government is telling us the straight scoop, whereas the ISI is the rogue organization. So anything that goes wrong, we can blame it on the ISI, when there's never been any one bit of daylight between the prime minister, the head of the military, and the head of the ISI. And the same, seems to be with our attitudes towards Russia and Putin, the inability to recognize who this guy really is. That we sort of have a foreign policy based on comfortable delusions rather than uncomfortable facts. And that takes you back to people like Sam Adams in the Vietnam War, who kept telling everybody in the upper echelons of the government that we were losing the Vietnam War when Westmoreland Company were telling everybody we were winning it.
Well, actually, I knew Sam Adams very well. He was a close colleague of mine, and that's not what he was arguing. He was arguing basically a war of numbers. He had a very good estimate that turned out to be highly accurate of how many Viet Cong there really were. So if you looked at the Pentagon numbers, which were half of what the Viet Cong really was made up of, We would have wiped out the Viet Cong if you looked at the Pentagon estimates of the Viet Cong and the kill ratios that the Pentagon was announcing on a regular basis. But in that war of numbers, Sam Adams was fighting the good fight, but he was fighting it alone. That was a classic case of politicization. And the Vietnam War involved a lot of politicization of intelligence. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution was based on politicized intelligence about whether or not North Vietnam had really attacked a U.S. Naval ship. And there's always this danger. The Iraq War was based on politicized intelligence. You had a Vice President Dick Cheney going out to the CIA about a dozen times, but the job of any analyst, and certainly it was the way I interpreted my role as a intelligence analyst, was to tell truth to power. So if the administration is wrong about the intelligence, you have to tell them that. I remember as a very junior analyst in 1967, I wrote the memo from the task force that had been established to tell the White House that Israel had conducted a preemptive attack. And it came flying back from Walt Rostow because he said he had a guarantee from the Israeli ambassador that they would not preempt in the 1967 confrontation. But that's exactly what the Israelis did. But we had a CIA director, Richard Helms, who said, make some editorial changes, but send it back. If that's what the intelligence says, that's what you have to tell the White House. And, of course, that assessment was totally accurate. But if you have a CIA director such as a Jim Schlesinger or a George Tenet or a Porter Goss or a John Brennan, you're not going to find examples of telling truth to power. These are bureaucrats who are trying to aggregate their own power to as great a degree as possible and develop a close relationship with the president, and certainly they're not going to endorse the idea of telling truth to power. And whenever this happens, it's the government and the country that suffer, and we've seen that happen over and over again.
Well, Mel Goodman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Always good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back getting a profile of the freshman Tea Party Republican Senator Tom Cotton, who drafted the open letter to the Iranian leadership signed by 46 other Republican senators. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gene Lines, who's a nationally syndicated columnist at the Arkansas Times and the co-author of The Hunting of the President, The 10-Year Campaign to Destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. And his other books include The Higher Illiteracy, Widow's Web, and Fools for Scandal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gene Lines.
Hey, Ian. It's nice to be with you again.
And Gene, before we get on to looking into who this Senator Tom Cotton is of Arkansas, the freshman senator, I don't know whether you saw Hillary's press conference today, but there was a real search for scandal there. I'm not sure that in that rather brief press conference at which she was clearly uncomfortable that she put it to rest. Do you think she did?
No, I don't think anything can put it to rest. I mean, I also don't. This is almost from the point of view of the people who have been raising these kinds of issues about Hillary Clinton since she came into public attention. I mean, we've known about her for longer than that, but I mean, in the early 90s, it's almost perfect because there's not going to be any evidence to confirm or refute the dark suspicions this time. I think it's just eventually going to peter out. People are going to have to decide how important do you think it is that you can't read all of the the Secretary of State's emails. And you do have to decide, do you trust her not to hide evidence of her torrid love affair with Vladimir Putin or her membership in the Ladies Auxiliary of the Muslim Brotherhood? I think eventually it'll peter out because there won't be more fuel for the fire, if that makes any sense.
Well, you certainly, you know, chronicled the manufacture scandal that was going on in Arkansas throughout their entire presidency. White water and all of these ridiculous things. There was never a there, but there seems at least to be some kind of a there, but not the one that they're hunting. It just seems almost reflexive that there has to be a scandal rather than because you could have a really substantive debate about internet privacy and security and the double standard that government officials want and the government itself wants to protect its privacy while ordinary citizens have no privacy.
Well, that's certainly an issue.
Well, let's talk about Tom Cotton, the freshman senator who just got elected in Arkansas. First of all, why did he get elected? Is it because in these midterms the Democrats don't show up? Or how much was the fact that the incumbent was not a particularly good candidate?
Well, I think I don't think that Mark Pryor could have won in any year. Although I must say the last time he ran, which was during a presidential year, he didn't get a Republican opponent because he was seen as straddling the great broad middle of Arkansas politics where most people are. But this time around, it was all the election was a referendum on Obama. I mean, Tom Cotton is, at least in the television sense, a very plausible candidate. I mean, he's a tall, handsome fellow. He's got a couple of degrees from Harvard. He's done time in the army in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he, you know, makes a good appearance in a television commercial. And his television commercials basically for the better part of a year were a vote for Mark Pryor is a vote for Obama, a vote for Mark Pryor is a vote for Obama. And I think that a lot of people on the Pryor side who were accustomed to being Mark Pryor was sort of a legacy of his father, maybe the most popular politician in Arkansas, but also a politician who's in his middle 70s. And I think that the people around Mark Pryor forgot that there's a whole generation of people who don't remember when David Pryor was a senator, don't remember when David Pryor was governor, and didn't really know much about Mark Pryor, who's kind of a...
Right,
a dull establishmentarian. Let me put it that way.
Right, but didn't the whole Tom Cotton campaign, and this is the same of what happened down in Louisiana, for example, with Mary Landrieu, they in that campaign they never showed pictures of the guy, the Democrat. They only showed pictures of Obama, the black man. So, was that the subtext there? That
there weren't many attacks on Pryor. It was basically that a vote. It was basically a vote for Pryor is a vote for Obama. The Pryor voted for Obamacare, and that's not it. Although it's doing a tremendous amount of good for the state, this state under even our Republican governor did the Medicaid expansion. There's been a tremendous increase in two things: the number of people covered by Medicaid and by private insurance, and also the health of the hospitals. Rural Arkansas hospitals were in terrible trouble. They're much better off now. It's done the state quite a lot of good, but it's still wildly unpopular with people. who get all their news from, I don't know where they get it from, honestly, probably Fox News, the ones who get news.
Right. Well, it's hard to believe that Pryor could have run such a feckless campaign where he ran away from Obama at every turn, and obviously the subtext was that a vote for Pryor is a vote for the black man. I think they were pretty shameless throughout the whole South, the way the Republicans ran in this last election.
Well, I didn't need to say anything, Ian. It's important to note. I mean, Obama's unpopularity is so great that it didn't need to be said or even hinted at. Just mentioning his name was enough.
Right. But the Pryor and company ran away from, you know, for example, the raising the minimum wage. It was a referendum, and it won. But he didn't want to even associate himself with that because he thought it tied him to Obama. So if you run away from your own president, it makes you look like you're apologizing somehow effectively endorsing these dreadful canards that have been thrown out there about Obama.
Yeah, I mean, he really made no affirmative defense of himself except to try to point out ways in which he wasn't Obama. And that was, I agree with you that was a mistake. I also don't think anything could have saved him.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Gene Lyons, a nationally syndicated columnist at the Arkansas Times and the co-author of The Hunting of the President, the 10-Year Campaign to Destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. His other books include The Higher Illiteracy and Widow's Web and Fools for Scandal. So how did, Tom Cotton, he may have gone to Harvard and so did, of course, Ted Cruz. They're educated people, but they're right-wing ideologues. And in the case of Cotton, this open letter to the Iranian leadership is beyond belief in the way that it sort of starts out in this hilariously patronizing way to the Iranians, sort of as a, you know, well, you guys don't understand constitutional democracy, but, you know, we're going to give you a little lesson here. Well, to begin with, it would seem that, you know, Tom Cotton doesn't understand constitutional democracy, that the president makes foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think the audience for the thing was not particularly the Iranian government. It was, I mean, the content of it didn't matter. What mattered was the fact of it. And what he's basically saying is, we're about to be done with this guy, and when we're done with him, we're taking over. And good luck to you. He wants war. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that he wants a war with Iran. He is much more ideological than I would have believed anyone of his seeming intelligence could be. And he's much more convinced that that it's a fight between good and evil. We're good, they're evil, and that's all there is to say about it.
So did he, how did he respond to the criticism coming from Obama as well as across the board, including from a lot of Republicans? It's worth noting that the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Corker, did not sign off on this letter and made the point that he and Menendez are trying to actually get a veto-proof bill that would, for the Senate to actually, you know, approve this deal once it's made. And now, of course, because the Democrats have been so infuriated by this partisan act on the part of these 47 Republicans, they're not likely to go along with Corker's plan.
No, they're not likely to go along with it. All I can say is all I've done, is, like everyone else today, is I had to write a column today about something else, but so I didn't spend all day at it. I saw him a couple of times on television, and he gives the impression of being serene and confident and even condescending toward anyone who disagrees with him. He's the man who has the truth, and the rest of us are going to have to learn to adjust to it. That seems to be the way he's taking it, and we'll see what happens if the idea takes hold generally, which I think it probably will, that this was a rookie mistake, we'll see how he adjusts to that. He's never been known to admit error or to admit either error or complexity for all of his seeming intelligence. Everything's all very simple. And, you know, the funny thing is, I've lived here in Arkansas since 1972. I followed my wife home from school, is the short version of the story. And as long as I've been in Arkansas, people like Tom Cotton, I'm speaking now ideologically, not educationally, but the extreme fundamentalist right wing has made all the noise, written all the angry letters, pounded on all the desks, and lost all the elections badly. It's only with the Obama administration that all this has come to pass. The entire political structure of the state has been turned inside out. We had middle-of-the-road establishment Democrats like Mark Pryor, like his father, like Dale Bumpers, and like Bill Clinton for the entire time I've lived here, and suddenly they're all gone, and Democrats in the state appear to be powerless and disenfranchised.
So what's your explanation for that?
All I can say is it seems to be all about Obama. I don't sense in my dealings with people that the state has changed all that much, that the people have changed. The same people are still fulminating about the same things, but somehow the Obama's presidency has just shocked a lot of people into going down this road. And we've now got a legislature that's just doing mad things day after day. When I say mad things, a year ago they passed a law allowing people to carry guns on college campuses unless the college campus decided it didn't want guns. Every single college in Arkansas said, no guns, please. So this year they've come back and they passed a law requiring campuses to admit, you know, concealed carry pistols, whether they want to or not. That's the kind of thing that's going on day by day.
Well, you know, Tom Cotton got helped a lot by the Koch brothers. It's not entirely.
Yes.
I mean, the fact that you have a black president is obviously unhinging a lot of people. But secondly,
yes,
the fact that these plutocrats are spending endless amounts of money because of the Supreme Court decision is certainly helping, surely. But
absolutely. You couldn't turn on the television during the last year without seeing two or three Tom Cotton ads.
Right.
And that was just, they blitzed the state to a degree that was hard to believe. They were just on constantly, and people are just hearing that message over and over and over again.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary, and we'll see whether or not Tom Cotton gets charged with the Logan Act.
No, he's not gonna. I mean, no, I don't. I think that a senator can do what they do. I mean, I think a U.S.
Yeah.
senator isn't a private citizen, so the Logan Act doesn't really apply. But,
in spirit, it certainly does. You know, even if he's got immunity being a senator. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Gene Lyons.
Well, it's been nice talking to you again, and I don't know if I can shed much light on the place I live anymore because it's all changed so fast and it's very confusing. And yet daily life doesn't seem changed at all.
Well,
if that makes any sense.
Well, I thank you again, Gene. And again,
okay.
I've been speaking with Gene Lyons, who's a nationally syndicated columnist at the Arkansas Times and the co-author of The Hunting of the President, the 10-year campaign to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. His other books include The High Illiteracy, Widow's Web, and Fools for Scandal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.